This meeting of the House Health and Social Services Committee will now come to order. It is 3:05 p.m. Tuesday, February 28th, 2017, in the State Capitol Room 106. Members present are Representative Eastman, Representative Keto, Representative Johnston, and myself, Representative Sponholz. Let the record reflect that we have a quorum to conduct business. Take this moment to silence your cell phones if you haven't already, including going all the way off from vibrate. Before we start the meeting, I want to thank Butch Carber, the House Hess Secretary from Records, and Alex B.B. Gudice from the Juneau LIO for staffing the committee today, and Ted Mattson, who is the committee aide and works for me. Today we're going to be hearing two bills and a presentation. The first bill up will be HB 25, which is insurance coverage for contraceptives. We will be hearing from the bill sponsor and invited testimony, and then we'll hold it over for a future committee hearing. The second bill will be HB 43, New Drugs for the Terminally Ill. We'll be hearing from the bill sponsor and invited testimony, and then holding over that bill for Thursday's committee hearing. Finally, we'll be hearing from Dr. Ann Zink, Ben Zaniello, and Connie Beamer from the Alaska State Hospital and Nursing Home Association, or ASHNA's, work towards reducing overusage of emergency departments. Let the record reflect that Representative Edgman has joined us. And now I would like to invite Representative Klayman and his staff up to present HB 25, insurance coverage for contraceptions. Put yourself on the record and begin the introduction of the bill. Thanks.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Matt Klayman, and I am the state representative for House District 21 in West Anchorage. First off, I would like to thank you all for hearing House Bill 25 this afternoon. All across Alaska, women do not always have ready access to women's health services. Women living and working in rural areas, the tourism industry, the military, and in the North Slope face additional barriers, geographical and otherwise, to obtaining greater access to family planning options. Currently, women who use hormonal contraceptives must return to the pharmacy every month to 3 months to refill their prescriptions. House Bill 25 requires health insurers to offer consumers the option to receive a 12-month supply of hormonal contraception at a time. The women in my family support House Bill 25, and that tells me a lot. They support it not only because it is often time-consuming and inconvenient to obtain a prescription contraceptive every 3 months, or in some cases every month, but they support it because they know that improved access to contraceptives means huge reductions in unintended pregnancies. Unintended pregnancy has a profound effect on the overall well-being of Alaskan families. Unintended pregnancy is associated with adverse maternal and child health outcomes. Along with health concerns, unintended pregnancy is a dramatic cost driver to public health programs. I believe, and I hope members of the committee will agree, that with Alaska's financial challenges, we should look for ways to reduce costs in the short term and long term, and this bill does exactly that. House Bill 25 makes sense for Alaska women and families. With that, I will turn it over to my staff, Lizzie Kubitz, to explain the details of the bill.
Thank you, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Lizzie Kubitz, and I'm staff to Representative Klayman. Thank you all for hearing House Bill 25 today. House Bill 25 mandates that health care insurers provide coverage for a 12-month supply of contraceptives at one time. In the bill, prescriptive contraceptives include self-administered hormonal contraceptives that do not require insertion or other types of administration by a medical professional, namely oral contraceptives. Section 1 of the bill lays this out. Section 1 also includes a religious exemption and defines a health care insurer as including a self-insured employer, such as the state. Section 2 of the bill directs the Department of Health and Social Services to cover the 12-month supply of prescription contraceptives for eligible recipients of medical assistance. Section 3 of the bill directs the Department of Health and Social Services to amend and submit for federal approval a state plan for medical assistance coverage consistent with Section 2. Section 4 is a conditional effect of Section 2 of the bill, and Sections 5 and 6 pertain to effective dates. One major premise behind House Bill 25 is that when women have greater access and availability to contraceptives, unintended pregnancies are reduced. reductions in unintended pregnancies have a direct cost savings to the state, which is reflected in the fiscal notes from the Department of Health and Social Services. And I will note for the record that Margaret Brody from the department is online and available to answer questions about the department fiscal notes. According to a study, which I believe is included in your bill packets, in 2010, 48% of all pregnancies in Alaska were unintended. Additionally, the study estimates that 94.3% of the unintended pregnancies in 2010 were publicly funded. As a state, Alaska spent $113.7 million on unintended pregnancies. Of that, $70.8 million was paid for by the federal government, and $42.9 million was paid by the state. An additional study included in your packet looks at 84,000 women in California who were given various supplies, 1 month, 3 months, and year-long of oral contraceptives. The researchers of that study observed a 30% reduction in the odds of conceiving an unintended pregnancy when given the year-long supply of oral contraceptives. That study also showed that over the course of the year, California's family planning program paid $99 more annually for women who received three cycles and $44 more for women who received one cycle than it did for women who received a year-long supply all at once. This was mostly due to the costs of associated visits and the higher use of pregnancy tests among women who received fewer cycles. Women who received three cycles were almost twice as likely as women who received the 12-month supply to visit a clinic to get a pregnancy test. It is important to note that this bill does not change who is eligible for coverage or what types of prescriptions are being covered. All the bill does is allow women who already receive coverage for prescription contraceptives to receive, if she so chooses, 12 months of that prescription at one time. And I wanted to take a moment to address some concerns we've received from two groups, the first being the Alaska National Federation of Independent Business, NFIB, and America's Health Insurance Plan, AHIP. NFIB, and I think there's a letter included in your bill packets, has brought forward concerns about whether this bill would apply to the state employee programs. We've addressed that concern with the inclusion of the definition of a health care insurer to include self-insured employers such as the state. An additional concern from the NFIB is the cost burden of supplying 12 months of contraception at one time. In response to that concern, multiple studies have found that contraceptive coverage does not raise insurance premiums and that employers providing coverage can, in fact, save money by avoiding costs associated with unintended pregnancy. According to a study by Truven Health Analytics that was commissioned by a number of health groups, the average commercial insurer payment for all maternal and newborn care ranges from about $18,000 to $28,000. The average hormonal birth control costs range from about $100 to $600 a year. By preventing just one unintended pregnancy, an insurer can save a minimum of $17,000, which is enough savings to pay for 29 additional years of contraception. AHIP also brought forward some concerns, which they have a backgrounder for, which I believe is also in your bill packets. Their initial concern is that the 12-month supply of contraceptives could compromise patient safety due to potential decreased visits to a prescribing physician. To address that, research shows that birth control pills are safe and can be safely prescribed based on a careful review of your medical history and blood pressure measurement. For most women, no further exams are necessary after that first dispensing unless women would like to follow up during their yearly exam that they're recommended to have. The Centers for Disease Control and World Health Organization presented a study in 2013 that recommended dispensing a year's supply of contraception and advising women to return at any time to discuss side effects or other problems or if she wanted to change her method, but that no routine follow-up is required. They also had a concern regarding efficacy due to potential improper storage of 12 months of contraceptives being supplied. According to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, oral contraceptives have a shelf life of 3 to 5 years, depending on the manufacturer. This time frame can be diminished depending on things like temperature and moisture, but we trust that women who would opt for a 12-month supply, who are regular users of hormonal contraception, know how to properly store their medication. There's also concerns regarding waste, fraud, and abuse. In the study that's included in your bill packets, the researchers in California found that women who were dispensed a year-long supply on average wasted about one cycle of prescription contraceptives. Wasting one cycle of pills is fairly insignificant in comparison to all of the other cost savings, such as fewer total clinician and pharmacy visits and associated costs with pregnancy and so on. Additionally, there was the concern of fraud and abuse. In the unlikely event that women begin to sell off their hormonal contraception supply, there are existing criminal statutes to address that. However, because this legislation would make birth control more accessible, we don't anticipate a booming black market business, as women would have greater access to these prescriptions due to this legislation.
Ms. Kubitz, I'm just going to pause for a second here to recognize that Representative Sullivan Leonard has joined us. Thank you. Continue.
So with that, overall, House Bill 25 would have huge advantages for Alaskan women. From eliminating the inconvenience of refilling the prescription every 1 to 3 months at a time, to the real inability for some Alaskan women to make it to the clinic, hospital, or pharmacy to refill that prescription at all. Fisherwomen sometimes spend 3 to 4 months out on a boat at one time. Women who are attending college often have busy schedules balancing school and a job. And women in rural Alaska often have trouble making it to the clinic or hospital due to lack of transportation and limited operating hours. House Bill 25 ensures all Alaskan women's freedom to make decisions about their futures. And with that, we'd be happy to answer any questions the committee has.
Thank you, Ms. Kubitz. Representative Johnston.
Thank you, through the chair. First of all, I have to say that a couple of weeks ago, I found out our daughter, who's here from Norway, went to get some birth control pills, and for a 3-month supply, it was $800. So I was impressed. That being said, has there been any study as far as discounts for having 12 months versus 3 months?
Through the chair, Representative Johnston, through a little bit of research of my own, I have seen that often when you buy in bulk, there is a cost savings. So I think somebody who is potentially a private insurer could probably speak to that better than myself, but...
Okay. Might be something to look into. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Sure. Is there any other questions?
This bill obviously has a zero fiscal note, right?
Through the chair, Representative Edgman, there's a few fiscal notes.
I didn't see my bag.
Let me pull them up here. Yeah, so there is a zero fiscal note that was provided by the Division of Insurance, and then there are two different fiscal notes from the Department of Health and Social Services. The first shows an anticipated cost due to implementation of this, and then the second shows cost savings. Mm-hmm. And I think Margaret Brody is online, and she could potentially speak to the Department of Health and Social Services fiscal notes for Medicaid services.
Ms. Brady, are you on the line?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, I am.
Could you walk us through the fiscal notes?
Yes. For the record, my name is Margaret Brody. I'm the Director of Healthcare Services for the State of Alaska. And, Madam Chair, the first fiscal note is number 2077, OMB number. And the first fiscal note is doing some analysis. Right now, or at the time that we did the fiscal note, there was 7,940 female Medicaid recipients using oral contraceptives. Mm-hmm. And it's anticipated that 10% or 794 users may require duplication of services, mm-hmm. and that's where their medication isn't effective, or we need to replace, lost, or stolen, or if, as was stated before, if they aren't stored properly, they could lose their efficacy. And so there's a small percentage that would have to be replaced. And we base the replacement value at $45 a month. That's based on the national average drug acquisition cost, which is what the state of Alaska uses to determine what we will pay for pharmacy. The next part is we assume that 75% or 6,000 plan to use oral contraceptives longer than 12 months. There's a standard failure rate of 9% cited by the CDC. So that would mean that 540 unintended pregnancies would result as a result of that. The failure rate would be decreased approximately 30% with a 12-month supply. And that would decrease the failure rate down to 6%. But we have a little bit higher than the national average, so we put our failure rate at 7%. And so we've stated that there will be 120 unintended pregnancies that can potentially be avoided by using this 12-month contraceptives. And so the savings that we were estimating is based on the Medicaid data of the births that we've had in the past of approximately 4.4%. 5.28 of the avoided 120 unintended pregnancies would have been complicated births, and the remaining 114 would have been non-complicated. The cost factor used for a complicated birth was $110,000. The cost factor used for non-complicated births was $8,000. Therefore, benefit savings to the Medicaid program is estimated to be $1,498,000, of which $562,000 will be attributed to the expansion population. And so the net annual projected savings, when you put them together, are $1,355,600.
And that's annually?
That is annually, yes. And that is also, I just want to point out that is being really conservative, because so much of the complicated births literally go into the hundreds of thousands of dollars. So this is the least expensive portion that we use for the savings. The second fiscal note is OMB component number 242. And this is for a position that would be required to, for when individuals go off the Medicaid program. So say somebody was given a 12-month supply in January, but their Medicaid ends on March 31st. Mm-hmm. It was anticipated that we would have to go back and collect the 9 months' worth of the cost of the prescription because the person was no longer on Medicaid. We are reviewing this further, and I actually believe that we can remove this fiscal note because there is not anything in federal statute, state statute, or our state plan amendment that says that we have to go back and collect these monies from the recipients.
I think that makes a lot of sense to save ourselves money in this particular area.
And I'd be happy to answer any questions, Madam Chair.
Does anybody have any questions for Ms. Brody? It looks like the long and the short of it is that we'd be saving 1.2 to $1.3 million a year in overall Medicaid costs related to contraception and unintended pregnancies then.
That's correct, Madam Chair.
All right. Representative Sullivan Leonard has a question.
I do, and this is for the maker of the bill. Hi, Mr. Klayman. Just reading through some of the information that's in the packet here, there's a note here that gives description of the Medicaid program with regard to coverage to contraceptives, that then this particular bill would not allow for the insurance program that covers state workers to also have this particular benefit offered. Is that correct?
Through the chair, I think that was one of the objections to the bill from one of the folks that have submitted written. But when we had the bill drafted, we specifically wanted this to apply to the health insurance program for self-insured entities, including the state. Mm-hmm. So it is the intent of the bill, and the language of the bill is that the health insurance program that is for state workers would have this requirement would apply to them as well.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I wanted to double check on that. Mm-hmm. And then follow up, Madam Chair.
Go ahead.
With regard to other medications that may be prescribed for patients, are there others that actually look at medications that could be prescribed on a yearly basis as opposed to up to 90 days? Mm-hmm. Is this the first time we're seeing something that's actually prescribed for a year?
Through the chair, Representative Sullivan Leonard, do you mean specifically contraceptives or just any medication overall? I am not aware of any medication that you can receive in the same manner, generally because, you know, they're often controlled substances, so you have to come back, but because the pill, or what is commonly known as the pill, is not, then it can be dispensed in a year's
time. Madam Chair? And that's the point I'm trying to get at. I was just trying to see if there are any other type of prescription drugs that physicians may look at. 90 days is 3 months supply. Usually that's because a physician wants to oversee certain type of drugs and their interactions on the patient or what have you. Mm-hmm. So I get the reasoning of wanting to help someone who may be on the slope or working out on fishing boats and wanting to have contraceptives for a longer period of time, but just trying to see if there are any other drugs that may be used or wanting to be prescribed for long term.
Through the chair, and we haven't researched that specific question.
Okay.
I have a memory in my own life that there were some medications that, particularly through some of these mail-in pharmacy programs the insurance companies want us to use, in which you could get 6 and 9 month prescriptions for certain medications. There are certainly certain other medications I'm fairly certain if I was getting a modern, a lot of discussion now, opioid-based pain medication, I don't think anyone's giving out opioid pain medication for 90 days.
I'm going there.
But I am familiar with instances in which you can get multi-month prescriptions. It depends much on the medication, I believe. I don't think there's a...
Okay. I'm curious. Thank you.
I believe, actually, based on personal experience, that there are other medications, some of which are hormonal, which you may receive for a full year's worth. So, but it might be worth producing some examples that are illustrative.
We can try. We can look into that.
Okay. Thanks,
Representative Sullivan Leonard.
Mm-hmm. Do we have any other questions for the bill sponsor or anybody that's on the phone? Jason. All right. Seeing none, it's my intent to hold this bill to a future meeting. We'll hear it again, and we'll have some opportunity for public testimony at that time. Thank you very much. And I think next we're going to hear from Representative Graham on HB 43. And do we need an at ease? We're going to take a brief at ease. Now back in order, and I would like to welcome Representative Jason Gren and his staff, Brooke Ivy, otherwise known as the other Ivy in the building, to come and present on HB 43, the right to try.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair, and the members of the committee. For the record, my name is Representative Jason Gren, proudly serving District 22 in Anchorage, Alaska, and I appreciate the opportunity to present this important piece of legislation for you today. Before I get started, I would like to notify members that Starley Coleman of the Goldwater Institute is joining us online today. Ms. Coleman has extensive knowledge of right-to-try legislation across the country and will be available to answer questions during her testimony later in the hearing. The goal of HB 43, or Right to Try, as it's commonly known, is to create a legal climate in which terminally ill patients who have exhausted all FDA-approved treatment options may work with their doctors and drug manufacturers to access investigational and safe treatments that have passed Phase 1 of the FDA approval process but are not yet widely available. Right to Try laws have now passed in 33 states. I won't tell you all of them. But also, right-to-try legislation is being considered in 15 additional states, now including Alaska. Each year, it's estimated that over 1 million Americans die from terminal illness. For those who have exhausted all FDA-approved options, clinical trials become the next step. However, of those patients who attempt to gain entry into a clinical trial, it is found that fewer than 3% are accepted. In recognition of the 97% of patients denied access to clinical trials, the FDA does have a program in place for accessing investigational drugs outside of clinical trials known as the Compassionate Use Program. Nevertheless, it's estimated that only about 1,200 people make it through this long, arduous federal process each year. Given this information, the goal of HB 43 is to provide the same access as the FDA's existing Compassionate Use Program, but on a shorter timeline. By ensuring terminally ill patients have more timely access to safe, though experimental drugs in consultation with their doctor, HB 43 attempts to offer new hope when all FDA-approved options have been exhausted. I will now defer to my staff, Brooke Ivy, to walk members through the bill. And I'd also allow you ask if I could be excused to run back to my committee.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Thank you, members of the committee.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you again for the opportunity to testify today on HB 43. For the record, my name is Brooke Ivy, staff to Representative Gren. So House Bill 43 has four sections. So a sectional analysis has been included in your packets for those who'd like to follow along, but I'll just walk through each one. Section 1 of the bill prohibits the state medical board from taking disciplinary action against physicians for prescribing or administering an investigational drug to a terminally ill patient that meets certain criteria. So patients under this section, they must be, one, ineligible or unable to participate in an ongoing clinical trial, two, have considered all available treatment options with consultation with their doctor, and three, have provided written consent. So that kind of helps you figure out who would be eligible for this program. Section 2 would add a new section in AS-0965 establishing that physicians, medical team members, manufacturers, importers, and distributors acting in good faith and with reasonable care will not be held liable in the case of injury or death of a terminally ill patient from the use of an investigational drug, provided that informed consent was obtained from the patient and notice of immunity was also given to the patient in advance. So they'll both know that there could be side effects as well as that their doctor or the manufacturer would have immunity. This section also establishes immunity for physicians and manufacturers who choose not to participate in distributing or prescribing investigational drugs. Section 3 would add a new section to AS 172110, the statute limiting the sale and distribution of new drugs. So the new section will allow physicians to prescribe or administer investigational drugs under the conditions established in Section 1. And finally, Section 4 would prevent the Department of Health and Social Services from acquiring a licensed healthcare facility to increase its services solely to accommodate physicians who are prescribing or administering investigational drugs to a patient. So moving on, as we talk about this bill, it's probably helpful for members to understand the actual FDA drug review process, so I'll just walk through that briefly. So prior to phase one is when sponsors of a drug are required to submit what's called an investigational new drug or IND application. It's through this application process the FDA reviews the applicant's preclinical testing results and they determine whether the drug is reasonably safe for testing in humans. Phase one studies occur after the approval of the investigational new drug application. These studies may be conducted on healthy volunteers in cases of testing on drugs like ibuprofen or anti-inflammatories or on individuals who have specific diseases or terminal illness. So the goal of phase one really is safety to determine possible side effects and toxicity levels. Phase two studies begin when a drug passes phase one and is therefore considered relatively safe, so there's no unacceptable toxicity levels. While phase one focuses on safety, phase two is focusing on the drug's effectiveness. And if there is evidence a drug is effective, it will then progress to phase three. This is where more information is gained on safety and effectiveness, particularly in varying populations, in different doses, that type of thing. So after phase three, sponsors of the drug then have a review meeting with the FDA and go on to complete a new drug application, which, if approved, would allow them to market the drug in the United States. From there, the FDA has 60 days to decide whether to officially file an application for review. Then, if it's filed, applications are generally processed within 10 months. So just as a wrap-up to that, when we're talking about investigational drugs in this bill, we're talking about those that have passed safety testing in phase one and are currently in ongoing clinical trials in phase two and phase three of that FDA process. So as mentioned earlier, the FDA does have an existing compassionate use program. It used to be called the Expanded Access Program. It's designed for terminally ill patients without access to clinical trials so that they can apply for these investigational treatments. To start the process, a patient must work with their doctor to apply directly to the FDA. Now, for years, up until very recently, this application form alone took approximately 100 hours for a doctor to complete. This is very arduous. Very recently, like I said, the FDA has actually made great strides in shortening this application form, but it's really just the first step in an approval process. So after they apply, manufacturers must also submit lengthy documentation. once complete, application paperwork must then make its way through the FDA internal approval process and then to a separate institutional review board, which is often a lengthy multi-month process. So about, as it says on the slide, approximately 1,200 applicants per year actually make it through that process. Finally, this is also in your packets, but it's just sort of a picture nationwide of this right to try laws, it's called. It's actually passed in 33 states, as Representative Gren mentioned. It's under consideration in 15 states, and it's only not been introduced in one state.
Madam Chair, may I ask a quick question?
Representative Sullivan-Leonard.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Ivey, if we could go back to the slide with the graphs here. You said approximately 1,200 applicants per year make it through.
That's correct.
Do you have a number on how many that don't?
I don't actually in front of me. It's possible that later on when Starley Coleman with the Goldwater Institute comes on the line, she may be able to answer that. But if not, I'm certainly able to get those numbers.
Follow up, Madam Chair.
Go ahead.
I just think it's an important component to your bill here. Thank you.
Thank you. So just a couple notes about your packets. There are a couple items included I just wanted to touch on briefly before concluding and moving for questions. So there was a document included in your packet called Clinical Trials, entitled Clinical Trials. Now, while I just want to clarify, while HB 43 focuses on terminally ill patients who do not qualify for clinical trials, we felt the inclusion of these Alaskan stories would help illustrate the local experiences people have faced with terminal illness and just the benefit of simply having access to these drugs, whether it's through a clinical trial or not. So it kind of brings it home here. Additionally, there's a Goldwater Institute policy report in your packet, and it's just the introduction and conclusion, so it's not the full report, just to save on paper, but we will be making sure that's available, the full report's available on BASIS for members who are interested. The policy report goes into greater detail on the challenges of the FDA's compassionate use program and tells some specific patient stories as well. So, Madam Chair, members of the committee, this concludes my prepared testimony at this time. Thank you again for the opportunity, and happy to take questions. Also, just a reminder, we have Starley Coleman with the Goldwater Institute, who'd be happy to give a brief, some additional information and answer questions as well.
Fantastic. Before we hear from Starley Coleman, does anybody on the committee have any questions for Ivy? Ms. Ivy? Representative Farr.
Thank you, Madam Chairwoman. I'm just wondering if you can update us, because the 21st Century Cures Act that passed and was signed by President Obama just before he left office included some provisions to allow expansion of drug trials for non-approved drugs, and I just want to understand how that federal law would, you know, the recent changes interact with this.
Representative Tarr, through the chair, I apologize. I'm actually not familiar with that. That's a great question, so I will, I would have to get back to you on that information, okay, of the specifics on that.
All right. Representative Kito.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Through the chair, and Ms. Ivy, thank you for your presentation. One question I have in looking at that map of states that have passed or introduced, it shows that the state of Hawaii has vetoed. Is there any information that you might have for why the bill was vetoed in Hawaii?
Representative Kito, through the chair, yes, I can help shed some light on that. So actually, I have done some research into that, and unfortunately, we don't know exactly why Governor Ige decided to veto the law. It did pass both houses unanimously in Hawaii, and he has not since issued any sort of statement to determine why he vetoed. However, previously, Governor Jerry Brown in California had vetoed the law and has since changed his mind, and there's a suspicion that it might be for the same reasons, essentially that deferring to federal law and that there's the existing compassionate use program. And really what caused Governor Brown to change his mind was that one of his lead advisors ended up learning about a situation in Texas where the right to try law actually benefited a number of patients that are currently undergoing treatment from a experimental cancer drug that it caused him to realize that because the FDA had denied him access and then they were able to gain access through the right to try law in Texas, that there are instances where this is beneficial. So it's an assumption, but again, that's the information we have.
A separate question.
All right, go ahead.
Thank you, through the chair, Ms. Ivy. So the statement from the bill sponsor is that this is an opportunity for individuals that have terminal illnesses to try something that might not be standard operating procedure, I guess. It would seem to me that to wait until you have a diagnosis of a terminal illness, there might be opportunities before you get to that point to be able to benefit from some kind of treatment. And I would be curious as to why we are waiting until somebody is actually diagnosed as terminal, which means they're at the end of their lives, for prescribing or identifying some potential remedy versus somebody that might actually have an illness but has not been diagnosed as terminal yet.
Thank you, Representative Kito. Through the chair, That question was actually raised by other committee members in discussion and reaching out to some national advisors on this that have been following it across the country. You know, my understanding is that the preference right now is to try and keep a narrow focus, in that this is already something that's available through the FDA. So the idea of taking on preventative care might open the door to all medications that go through the FDA approval process, in which case that might be a larger federal policy discussion on how do we approve drugs in this country. And so that is simply why this particular bill is focused strictly on streamlining access to something that's already available through the FDA, but just may not be in a timely fashion for someone who doesn't have the time. Mm-hmm. So I hope that helps answer that.
I may be able to illuminate a little bit as well. One of the things that we know about a lot of medications is that there's sort of a cost of their efficacy, but there's also a cost of their side effects. And a very important part of the FDA approval process is being sure that a product, a new medication is not only safe but actually does what it says it's going to do, and that its benefits outweigh its costs. The FDA approval process is really set in place to protect us. A great example was one that I just read about in Atlantic Monthly. There's an article that was published in the last couple of weeks, which described actually the cost versus benefits, the side effects of prescribing aspirin to prevent heart disease and heart attack, when actually the number of patients, and I believe that these were middle-aged women or older women, that were being treated with aspirin, more of them had gastric problems as a side effect of taking the aspirin than actually had improved outcomes in their heart disease. And so we always have to be very careful about making sure that we don't have side effects that are very dangerous. And when you're talking about experimental drugs, there's a lot of ground to cover there that FDA approval process is really there to save us. So, but this is a good segue to a question that I had, and that is that, how is it that terminally ill is defined in this case? Because we're talking about potentially allowing people to have access to drugs that haven't been proven that they are totally safe. So what's the definition of terminally ill here?
Sure, Madam Chair. So I'll go ahead and just read the text of the bill too, so that's on the record. In Section 1, on page 2, line 12, terminal illness means a disease that, without life-sustaining procedures, will result in death in the near future or a state of permanent unconsciousness from which recovery is unlikely. And I could defer to legislative legal, the drafter who is online, if we'd like to hear further. My understanding is this is a widely used definition.
But. All right, and that's Linda Bruce?
Correct.
Are you on the line, Linda?
For the record, this is Linda Bruce of Legislative Legal.
Thank you. Could you describe that a little bit further? How would it, what other places is this definition used, and what was the source of that definition?
Madam Chair, this definition is not used elsewhere in the statute, so this is a new definition that has been drafted for this bill.
But if I may, I think this may have come from a model. Madam Chair. Mm-hmm. I think this may be originally from model legislation in other states, but I think legislative label, and I may need to check on that. But I can get back to you.
All right. Thank you. Representative Senator Leonard, did you have a question?
I do, Madam Chair. Thank you, through the chair, to Ms. Ivey. Just to follow up from Mr. Keto's discussion here, it was also a question that I had with Representative Grin in his office and also with Ms. Ivey. And to kind of follow up from that, we had talked about a little bit on the aspect that the information that's going to be collected with patients that are deemed to be terminal ill patients, What happens to that data then that's collected? And is that something then that could be used for other patients? It may, for example, be at stage 2 cancer, stage 3 cancer, or something as such? Thank you, through the chair.
Representative Sullivan Leonard, through the chair. Thank you. So, yes, that is actually something that the data from investigational drugs used outside of a clinical trial is, to my understanding, being collected. Some states have actually codified this in law. However, it's already a federal law that manufacturers need to provide this information to the FDA when prescribing or, providing a drug outside of a clinical trial, for example, through the Compassionate Use Program. So in their agreements, my understanding is under Right to Try, in their agreements to provide their medications or investigational drugs to the patient, they require that data be provided back to them for that purpose. And so to follow up on that, yes, it actually almost complements clinical trials in that regard as additional information on the drug's effectiveness comes to light.
That's great. Do we have any other questions for Ms. Ivey? All right, Representative Tarr.
Well, and more of a comment. Thank you, Madam Chair. And it just is a good opportunity for me to talk about this. Today is actually Rare Diseases Awareness Day, and this is another area where this Right to Try comes up, because it's the terminal illness part of it is for some of these, you know, rare diseases, because we, you know, don't have enough information and there's not a large enough population of individuals to sort of have statistically relevant information on their health outcomes and appropriate interventions, they often fall into these categories of really having to fight to get access to medications. So this is just something I'd worked on with Women in Government, and today, being that today is Rare Disease Awareness Day, there's a website about it, just rarediseaseday.org, that might be of interest to folks to kind of read up on some of those circumstances and the challenges that those families face, and pretty compelling in the sense that what has happened in the circumstances that I've learned about is, you know, oftentimes a parent basically has to become like a you know, one-person army to try and get access to information and organize communities of families where, you know, they have children with the same conditions, and just really challenging. So I think this is another opportunity for those families to have access. And it may be that their condition is so rare that, you know, the terminal illness part of it is just because it's so poorly understood, and maybe there are opportunities to save those individuals.
Yeah, absolutely. All right. Would Starley Coleman from the Goldwater Institute like to provide testimony?
Yes, thank you very much, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I am watching you online and listening as well, so I feel like I'm right there in the room with you. Thank you very much for allowing me to call in today to talk about the Alaska Right to Try Act. For the record, I'm Starley Coleman, the Vice President of Communications at the Goldwater Institute. We are the organization that crafted the language upon which your bill is based, although there have been some Alaska-specific tweaks made, as Ms. Ivey mentioned. So I wanted to pick up on a couple of items that have been discussed already this afternoon. So right now, as was discussed earlier, if you're diagnosed with a terminal illness and you have exhausted all of your approved options, there are really three paths to accessing promising investigational treatments. The first path is for the lucky, and those are the clinical trials. The second path is for the rich. Those are people who can afford to travel overseas to access drugs that are already available in other countries but not yet in the United States. And the third path is really for the connected, and that's that FDA compassionate use or expanded access program that has been discussed. For everyone else, there's really no path to accessing investigational treatments, and that's why we created the Right to Try. And it's really important to understand that the Right to Try is the opposite of the Right to Die. The Right to Die movement is for people who are done with treatments and ready to end their own lives. And this is for people who are in the exact opposite position. This is for people who are not done fighting and they want another chance. Right to Try allows patients with terminal illnesses who have tried all existing treatments with no success and who cannot enroll in a clinical trial to access promising treatments that are being safely used in government-approved clinical trials. And it's also important to be clear about the kinds of treatments we're talking about here for people with terminal conditions. You know, we're not talking about pimple cream for healthy teenagers. We're talking about people with Lou Gehrig's disease and brain cancer and spinal muscular atrophy, which is a disease that kills babies by the time they're 2 years old. And, you know, we really like to think of this issue this way. So if you were on a sinking ship, would you pass the only available lifeboat because the government hadn't finished certifying it yet? No, of course you wouldn't. You'd say put the lifeboat in the water, and Right to Try gets the lifeboat in the water. So one of the questions that have come up already is whether or not trying an investigational treatment might be too risky. And the real issue here is that the risk for someone who takes a drug under Right to Try is exactly the same as patients who are lucky enough to get into government-sanctioned clinical trials. They're the exact same treatments that the FDA is allowing a handful of people already to take. And so then normal follow-up question to that would be, why don't more people just enroll in clinical trials or sign up for one? And the answer is, as I'm sure many of you know, that it's really hard to be selected for a clinical trial. You have to be just sick enough, but not too sick. Earlier I mentioned a disease called spinal muscular atrophy. SMA is the number one genetic killer of children, and it is fatal 100% of the time. And normally children who are diagnosed with SMA die before their second birthday. There's one drug under development for SMA in the entire world, and it's being developed here in the United States. And there were 8 children chosen for the clinical trial. 8. Even though it's the number one genetic killer of children. It will be about 5 to 7 more years before this drug makes it all the way through its approval process. That means that every baby with SMA that is alive today and born with the disease over the next 3 years will die before they have a chance to take a drug that is already showing tremendous promise in this FDA-approved clinical trial. For the 2 years that the drug has been in trial, the children who have been treated are seemingly unaffected by the disease, meaning they're normal, healthy babies. And as has also been discussed, fewer than 3% of cancer patients are selected for clinical trials. So that means that 97% of cancer patients have to rely on drugs that are already on the market, even if a drug in a clinical trial is being developed specifically for their individual type of cancer and is already approved in saving lives in other countries. 5 years ago, a little boy in Phoenix, Arizona, named Diego Morris, was diagnosed with osteosarcoma, which is a rare and deadly bone cancer. Diego was treated by experts at St. Jude's in Memphis, and they quickly exhausted all of his available treatment options. His doctors recommended that his family find a way to relocate to another country to access a successful treatment that was not yet available here in the United States. So Diego's parents are both lawyers, and they do well for themselves, so they were able to move their family to England for a year, where Diego was able to be treated with a drug that has been given Europe's most prestigious prize for breakthrough medicines, but is still not available in the United States. And today, Diego is alive and a healthy teenage boy. So if you're rich, you can afford to access promising treatments in other countries, but there are a whole lot of people in this country who can't afford to move to England, and Right to Try gives these people a path to try drugs at home. So let's talk just for a minute, because the FDA process has been discussed quite a bit here. Let's talk about the lucky few who are able to get through that FDA expanded access process. So as was mentioned earlier, about 1,200 people a year make it through the application process. The question came up about how many applications are declined, and the answer to that is we don't know because the FDA doesn't keep a record of that information. They don't tell us how many applications come in. They say that their statistic of approval is about 99%. and we have no reason to doubt that that's an accurate statistic. But here's why that's not a very helpful number. We talked to a doctor named Rizal Kurzrock, who ran clinical trials for MD Anderson Cancer Center in Houston. Her trial center was the largest center in the world, and she said that she was able to get one person through the FDA expanded access process every year. One. In the largest trial center in the world. So she said that FDA's number of 99% approval is really like a self-fulfilling prophecy, because doctors who know how the process works call the FDA in advance and they talk to them about their patient's situation. And if the FDA says verbally, we're not going to go for that, then they don't even bother putting in the application. So the real issue for you, I think, in Alaska specifically, is you have to think about if a person who is being treated at the largest cancer trial center in the world has a slim chance of getting through the FDA process with doctors who are trained in how to use the process. They know who to call at the FDA. They know how it all works. Imagine what it's like for a person in Alaska who's seen a community oncologist who's never run a trial before, has never used the FDA compassionate use process before, and doesn't even know who to call at the FDA. The chances are just not good that that program is going to be helpful to a regular person who is not being treated at a major research hospital. And, you know, by a point of comparison, in France, they have a similar program, and 25,000 people every year are able to make it through their process. So France is about a fifth the size of the United States population-wise, and they're able to help 2,000% more people than we can. So there's clearly a problem with the way that our program is working. So as we've worked on this issue across the country, I've met hundreds of patients and their families, and they all say the same thing. No one expects a guarantee that an investigational drug will cure them, but they just want to try. They just want the choice to take the same medications that are being used in clinical trials. They just want to be able to say that they've tried everything they could. And we believe that we owe dying people and their families that opportunity. So as Ms. Ivey mentioned, the good news is we know Right to Try is working and saving lives today. There's a doctor in Texas who has successfully treated nearly 100 patients with a treatment has been in clinical trial in the United States and has been available in Europe for decades. So these patients are terminal pancreatic cancer patients, and many of them who've been treated for more than a year now are still with us today. So we look at that as a real success story of something that we can do as states that complements the federal government's drug approval process, doesn't compete with it, complements it, and really makes something workable for patients in all walks of life. And we fundamentally believe that the right to save your own life is a human right, and that when you're fighting for your life, you shouldn't have to fight government red tape on top of everything else you're dealing with. And that is why we really hope that we can count on your support for the Right to Try Act.
Representative Johnson.
Yes, thank you to the chair. As I look at, I want to make sure I understand this. This is a right to try drugs that have gone through the FDA approval first step and either second or third step, right?
Through the chair, Representative Johnston, they have all passed phase one,
right?
So the safety testing, and are currently in phase two or three.
Because I was just, our speaker had mentioned the European solution a number of times, and that would only be allowed if those drugs were within the FDA system, had done phase one, and were in the process of two or three. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Representative Johnston, that is correct. So there are, you know, several countries where there may be medications or treatments in general use that are considered safe and effective in those countries, but they would still need to start in phase one of the FDA process in our country in order for them to be eligible through the right to try, unless a person was to travel to that country and utilize the medication there, which is outside of this process. So,
and
Madam Chair, may I also add on to that?
Go ahead, Ms. Coleman.
Thank you. Thank you, Representative Johnson, through the chair. Here's an example of how that would work. There are currently five investigational treatments for breast cancer in the FDA pipeline today that have been approved in other countries and are working and saving lives. So, for example, Right to Try would make those five treatments that we know work and we know are safe because they're in use around the world available to American women.
Thank you. Is there any other questions for either Ms. Ivey or Ms. Coleman? All right, Ms. Coleman, I have a question for you. For how many people, nationwide have Right to Try bills sort of created or legislation created access to treatment? Do we have any idea of how many people have been affected or have taken advantage of this new access?
Madam Chair, thank you very much for that question. We unfortunately do not have a complete record of that. We, as I mentioned, we know that there's a doctor in Texas who's treating patients. We also know that there have been patients in Oregon and Florida who have been able to access treatments under their state Right to Try laws. As you will note, in your bill, and as Ms. Ivey indicated, there's no state-specific reporting requirements for the use of drugs under a state Right to Try law. Part of that is because it would be duplicative of what drug companies are already required to report to the FDA. But unfortunately, the FDA does not make that information available under public records law. So there isn't a way for us to give you a full picture of how many patients are being treated. Anything we learn about will be anecdotal based on a patient or a doctor self-reporting essentially to us just to let us know that it's happening.
Mm-hmm. Representative Johnson, you have a question?
Yes, through the chair. I know of a case where there's a drug that is called BCG that's used for both bladder cancer and melanomas, but that isn't its purpose. Its purpose is a vaccine for TB, and I have personal experience with this. And would this qualify under this situation because it's gone through the safety test, but it would not necessarily, and I know there's a hospital in Santa Monica that uses this, but I don't think it's gone through the phase two or beginning for this type of treatment.
Representative Johnson, through the chair, without knowing more specifics about the exact spot or place in the trial process where this drug is, I wouldn't be able to comment accurately on that. Besides, to say this, the goal of Right to Try is really to provide access to any drug that has passed an initial safety trial and is in an ongoing trial and under active investigation to terminal patients. The interesting thing about what you just said is that for drugs that are approved already, all the way through the approval process, it is already legal for physicians to use those treatments for another purpose. That's termed off-label use, which I'm sure you are familiar with, and that is already legal. So if this drug or any other drug is already fully approved by the FDA, it can be used for another purpose.
Thank you.
All right. Any other questions? Representative Tarr?
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the
Ms. Coleman.
Coleman, sorry. I didn't have your name. I apologize. The one thing that I'm worried about, a little bit worried about is the part where it provides immunity. And I'm just wondering if in the other states that you've worked with, if that has ever been an issue. Medical malpractice provisions would still be in place. And so is that the protection that, you know, otherwise would protect an individual if they, you know, were felt like they were coerced or sort of pressured into using something that, you know, anyhow, that they felt pressured or coerced? I guess that circumstance is where I'd be concerned about immunity.
Thank you, Representative Truba Chair. That is a very human concern for you to have, and I totally share your concern in wanting to make sure that patients are protected from any kind of undue pressure to try something that they might not be fully comfortable with, and then also to make sure that that they are protected by from medical malpractice. So two things that I can point to two things are in your bill that serve as patient protections. First, patients must sign a fairly comprehensive informed consent document that lays out the notion that they are taking an investigational drug, that their side effects are not fully known, that it there could be a number of repercussions for their health that have not been fully explored because it is an investigational drug. And if a patient, when they get to the informed consent document, if that doesn't feel right for them, of course, this is fully voluntary. And another safety backstop there is that it's totally voluntary for a pharmaceutical company as well. If a pharmaceutical company feels like a doctor hasn't fully informed the patient, or they feel like the treatment protocol that the doctor is proposing is not quite right, or there's something that feels wrong to the pharmaceutical company, it is totally voluntary, and there is no incentive at all for a pharmaceutical company that will have to report negative data to the FDA to give a patient something that they don't think is going to help them. So there's really no incentive there for a pharmaceutical company to participate. But you are absolutely correct that medical malpractice laws are not impacted at all by this bill, so that is still in place. The point of the liability shield is just to make sure that doctors, hospitals, pharmaceutical companies understand that if a patient who is in a terminal situation, obviously by the very nature of that, their outlook and their prognosis is not good. And if they were to die while taking an investigational treatment, that in and of itself wouldn't be a reason for a hospital, a doctor, or a company to be sued. So that's really the idea of that liability protection there. But it does not remove any malpractice protection at all. And we are, we stand with you completely on that. There's no reason to touch those laws at all. They should always apply to patients in every circumstance.
Thank you.
Ms. Ivey, did you have a comment?
I did. Thank you, Madam Chair. Just in addition, Representative Tarr, through the chair, a couple other protections that you could find in the bill language would include that we're talking about medication that goes, investigational drugs that remain in ongoing trials, and what that was intended to do is to protect patients from maybe a manufacturer who decided to get a drug through phase one and due to cost, prohibitions would pull that but still be able to, issue that through doctors directly to patients. So by requiring that there's still an ongoing process through the FDA approval process, that kind of protects from that scenario. Additionally, I would note that my understanding is that under federal law, manufacturers cannot engage in the marketing and sale of unapproved drugs, and they actually are not legally permitted to sell investigational drugs for more than it costs to produce. So there's not, and there's actually been situations where the courts have awarded repayments for when that has happened. So there's not a cost benefit to manufacturers in participating in this way.
Thank you.
Ms. Ivey, I have a question for you. excuse me.
As it relates to informed consent, in the same section of the bill that you were sort of just referencing, I know that our conception of informed consent has changed a lot, and I don't know if there's other statute that relates to this. I see that it says,
in writing after presenting to the patient all treatment options. Does that mean that we're essentially committing that there's a verbal conversation where there's a discussion about, you know, the potential risks and benefits? So we're not just giving them an 8-point font size document to sign as they're feeling kind of desperate.
Madam Chair, that is my understanding, yes. In addition, all available treatment options would be anything else that is currently approved by the FDA before they go that route as well. So they've assessed that this is their the only remaining path.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah. And presenting to the patient presenting to the patient as written on page 2, line 26 and 27, that's the verbal conversation, right? That we're guaranteeing that a verbal conversation has happened. The doctor has gone through sort of the risks and benefits of a potential treatment, and then writing is a codification of that consent.
Madam Chair, that is the intent of the bill, but perhaps I can have a conversation with legal, or we can ask them now. But certainly that would be something that we could look at if we needed it to be amended into the bill to be very clear that a verbal conversation has happened. We could do that.
Okay.
Maybe open to that.
Okay, thank you. Representative Eastman, did you have a question?
No, actually, thank you, though.
All right. Any other questions or comments? All right, we will have public testimony on HB 43 on Thursday, so that this will be coming up again. Thank you very much for joining us today, Ms. Ivey, and momentarily we'll be hearing from ASHNA in a presentation on emergency department use. So we'll have a brief at ease while we wait for it to come up. We have Dr. Ann Zink, Ben Zaniello. Thank you. And Connie Beamer from the Alaska State Hospital Nursing Home Association today presenting to us on working on reducing usage of emergency departments. So could you guys proceed?
Great. Thank you. For the record, my name is Connie Beamer with the Alaska State Hospital Nursing Home Association. I am thrilled to be here today. This is the first time I've testified in a hearing. I've been with ASHNA for 5 years. I'm the Director of Member Services and Operations. This project comes from the Medicaid redesign efforts that it was, I think, initially proposed back in 2015 under the Paying for Value section of the final report of packages. And one of the reasons why we're here is because of the rising healthcare costs and then also, of course, the declining state budget. And so this was a project that ASHNA brought forward in collaboration with the Alaska Chapter of American College of Emergency Physicians to help solve some of the issues that we are seeing in Medicaid. I do want to mention that this project is not just focused on Medicaid patients, though. It really has all patients at the heart and the core of our mission. So we are here because we want to do the right things for our patients. So I think most of you in the room know that emergency rooms are a great place to go if you have an emergency, but it's not the best place in our hospitals to provide reoccurring primary care and behavioral health. So we want to address that, and we're doing so with the implementation of this project. We started after the passage of SB 74 right away. We convened a project kickoff meeting in May of 2016, and we're well on our way with implementation. I think we'll go through that as we proceed. The project is not something that we thought up of ourselves here in Alaska. We saw a project based on the Washington 7 best practices model, and we stole from some of their successes. We saw their successes and we wanted to steal them, so that's what we're working on. What they saw in Washington after implementation, they were under a financial pressures like we are here in the state, faced with the threat of the governor saying that they would not pay for more than 3 ED visits for Medicaid patients, they quickly put implementation across all of their EDs, I think within like 90 days. And so the first year, that was back in 2012, and the first year they started seeing these successes in the reduction of overall ED visits, reduction of frequent users, low acuity visits dropped, So, of course, it's okay for high acuity visits to come to our ED, but we don't necessarily want to be treating people in the wrong place at the wrong time. They also saw, most remarkably, a 24% reduction of narcotic prescriptions from the ED. And I think as an Alaskan, and as we all know, that opioid crisis right now is a big deal. And so we're going to tell you what we're doing in that area. So I'm going to turn over the mic to Dr. Ann Zink, who is the former president of the Alaska Chapter of American College of Emergency Physicians.
Thank you. For the record, I'm Dr. Ann Zink. I work at Matsu Regional Emergency Department in the Valley, and I'm excited to see some of you again. I had the opportunity to testify last year with SB 74, and I think this project really demonstrates what you do really matters, and this inclusion in the project and what happened with SB 74 has really taken off, and there's a lot of great things that are happening, a lot of great things that can build off of it. So this is the actual language from SB 74, so this is Alaska specific, and we took from what Washington State did, as Connie mentioned, as well as looked at Oregon and other states. What do they wish they did differently? What do they recommend that we look for, and what makes sense for this state? So basically, we asked to create an interdisciplinary process for identifying and minimizing the number of frequent emergency department visitors. We looked to create an electronic an information exchange mechanism so that we could have information that cross all IT platforms, or we call EMRs, electronic medical records, so we could have information and look at different vendors who could do that. A way to educate patients, and a way to get primary care and behavioral health follow-up within 96 hours. Also, part of this, we looked at creating statewide narcotic guidelines out of the emergency department. Most of you guys probably saw the article in the ADN last week about who gives you narcotics in the emergency department may determine your overall use 6 months later, as well as to have a chance to review the success and challenges of this program to move forward. So in doing this, we were able to ask to inclusion of the PDMP, and we started to move forward quickly. As Connie mentioned, we started to work with all the different hospitals to say what's working and what's not working. We started to work on our statewide opioid guidelines, but the big thing we did is to look for the IT system that would make sense to cross platforms. There's a couple different IT systems out there, and IT is not a simple task. Went through a rigorous process getting provider input. There's a saying in emergency medicine of five clicks to crazy. You can't go through too many different portals to miss the information. And we know clearly what EMRs can and can't do, and so we wanted a system that was going to be easy to use, interface friendly, and had potential to build off of not just this project but other projects. And through that process, CMT was decided as a collective medical technologies as an ideal partner, and so far has been working fantastic. So I'd like to turn it over to Ben Zerilla from CMT to talk a little bit about the IT platform.
Howdy, thanks for having me. For the record, Dr. Ben Zaniello, I'm the Chief Medical Officer of Collective Medical and also a practicing physician at Providence, but in Washington State. This is just 2 seconds on the background of the company. We're a small, mission-driven company that actually was started by an ER social worker in Idaho, very much focused around this exact problem, which is ER care coordination and sharing information between hospitals, but specifically around the use case of ERs and focusing on things like the opioid epidemic. But I think the most important point is when I talk about us being mission-driven, the opportunity to do what we've done in Washington State, in Oregon, what we're doing in California, West Virginia, New Mexico, and ultimately to create a national care coordination network is around this concept of medical uncertainty versus medical necessity. Dr. Zink mentioned earlier, it's not often a dialogue with a patient comes into an ED about optimizing their care around having a full level of knowledge. There's a lot of information asymmetry in the practice of medicine, particularly in the ED, where decisions have to be made quickly. And what our software does is provide that ED physician information about a patient so that they can reduce medical uncertainty. Medical necessity will always exist, but so much of medical practice is due to information and asymmetry around that medical uncertainty. So that's what we've been focused on. We're a very small company. We're around 30 employees, but again, we now have over 1,000 hospitals. We've never lost a customer in our over 10 years of existence, and we're really excited about this opportunity to work with the state of Alaska. The name of our product is called EDI, the Emergency Department Information Exchange, but again, most people call it, going back to the ED of everything has to move fast, it's just called EDI. Nobody calls it the Emergency Department Information Exchange. But What I want to point out is just two pieces. So one is we're very focused around that ED use case, but to be successful in the ED, to reduce information asymmetry, you need information from outside the ER. So what's exciting about this project and how it's been set up for Alaska is that it's not just health systems, it's not just ERs, but it's primary care, it's behavioral health, it's health plans, it's essentially all part of the care ecosystem, taking part in patient care, sharing care plans, and again, pushing as much information about a patient that comes from outside the walls of the hospital, outside those traditional care silos, and at the point of care to, again, to create better care and to reduce, ultimately, to reduce cost. I suspect this is impossible to read, but essentially, just enter to the record, this is an example of the type of data we share over our system, and it's really optimized over our 10 years existence on what care practitioners want to know. They want to know what other docs have seen a patient, what type of care providers, cardiologists, behaviorists, dialysis, that type of piece. Are there any care guidelines, care recommendations out there for this specific person? Are they seeing a psychiatrist that has a drug cascade that they recommend so that the ED provider doesn't have to guess with this particular patient? Why are they altered? Is it potentially due to a drug they took, or is it because they actually are bipolar and this is an organic illness for which we have very good treatment? Mm-hmm. Security events, so workplace safety, this is a big part of our software, this idea of sharing concerns about physical and verbal altercations that happened in one hospital. Now you can see that across all hospitals and, again, across mm-hmm. multiple states. And then finally, prescription drug monitoring information. This is not available yet in Alaska, but it's been available in our other states, and again, reduces that information asymmetry by letting ED practitioners know what sort of controlled substances that a patient may be on as they walk in the door.
So as we started to kind of figure out what sort of IT system was going forward, at the same time we were working with the ED providers in the state to say, what can we do right now and how can we get things off the ground together? We've always felt like we needed better guidelines to say what should we be prescribing out of the emergency department and what shouldn't we be prescribing. And you will also find in your packet the newly released final PDF version of the Alaska Emergency Department Opiate and Controlled Substances Prescribing Guidelines. So these were a really collaborative project with physicians from around, or maybe it's not in your packet, there's looks around.
For the record, this is Connie Beamer, and I will make sure you get there finalized yesterday, so they weren't ready in time for your packets, but I'll make sure that, yeah, they're in the PDF, so.
Thanks.
I think they're in
here. So this was a really, it was a collaborative project from emergency providers from around the state. It was great to get input from people who were working in very remote and rural conditions to say, you know, I might have a long time until I can get someone to their orthopedic appointment for their femur fracture, or I've got someone who's narcotic shopping from emergency department to emergency department. So these were based on the CDC guidelines and were really a collaborative project amongst providers around the state, and it was really nice to get everyone on the same page to say what these are. I think these are a great model and how providers really want to do the same thing. We want to work with the legislators instead of saying, okay, you can't write for more than 50 mil equivalents, or here are the real strict rules. What can we do? And in Washington State, just having these guidelines and getting providers back the information, here's where you're practicing compared to other people, made a huge difference in their overall narcotic dispensing out of the emergency department. And now the data shows from Washington State decreasing the deaths from heroin. So I think that we have a real ability to use these guidelines, getting that information back and engaging providers to doing the right choice, because I think that's what people want to be doing. Mm-hmm. So I think moving forward in the next step and the ultimate goal, we've been really trying to work with communities. We now have this IT platform decided. Ben and Connie have been on a roadshow around Alaska trying to kind of work on all of the business agreements and details with hospitals to get this in place. Once it's in place at a hospital, primary care providers can have free access to it. They can upload their care plans to it. In the Mat-Su area, we had a great meeting and included state troopers, EMS, the mental health court, saying how can we all work together. There's a ton of fantastic community providers that we have now really trying to do the right thing, making these great care plans for patients that in the emergency department, I don't have access to their information, and this would allow them to be able to show me the most important aspects of their information to move forward. So as we're moving forward and preparing, these are different organizations that we have collaborated with, but I think this is a huge opportunity to start to look at not just Medicaid patients, as this came out of the Medicaid redesign, but all patients. This is a chance for us to put patients first.
This is a chance to really reduce restrictions and decrease silos between different providers, because I think people really want to do the right thing. We want to reduce costs. We need tools to be able to do this. And I think this is the beginning step, and I think there's a lot of opportunity to move on this as well as other tools moving forward to reduce costs, to improve care and overall satisfaction and health within the state. So with that, we'll take questions.
Thank you. Representative Johnston.
All right, thank you through the chair. So as the Mat-Su medical director, would you encourage your facility to use this for all patients?
Yeah, so Representative Johnston, through the chair, it's a great question. This is emergency department specific in the sense that this isn't going to treat someone's femur fracture when they go home. You know, 3 days worth of pain medication or for shortest time. The emergency department, absolutely. All the emergency department physicians said this 100% makes sense. The urgent cares are involved with this, but this is slightly different than if someone's got chronic pain.
So if as far as using this IT platform, this would be used for all emergencies, not just Medicaid.
Correct, exactly right. So Representative Johnston, through the chair, this crosses all platforms, all patients. It also accesses data from Washington, Oregon, anywhere CMT also is in place. And so if somebody comes up here on a cruise ship and they've been getting significant, they've got a care plan. You know, you mentioned rare diseases day. If someone's got a rare disease, they can upload a care plan for that from Washington State when they were down there seeing at Seattle Children's. And then I can access it at Mat-Su Regional, even though we're two totally separate hospital systems with two separate EMRs.
So any hospital or any organization that uses this IT platform can interchange throughout the system?
Correct.
Thank you.
Representative Sullivan Leonard.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. And thank you, Dr. Zink. Nice to finally see you. How does this work then when you have a patient that comes into the emergency room and then you're wanting to share that information with another facility? Are there forms that are filled out that clearly highlight that and then also along with their HIPAA information?
Yeah, so fantastic. So, Representative, it's nice to meet you as well through the chair. So a couple different things. The different hospitals can set up what they want to be their criteria for what shows up. So it's within the tracking board. So when a patient checks into an emergency department, they agree to be treated via HIPAA. So we have access to their information by that. So when someone comes into the emergency department, and Ben is really the expert at the HIPAA law components of this, but they come in, I've got a bill, they've basically consented to treatment. Then I could access, there would be a little token or a little sign within my tracking board to say there's important information regarding this patient. This may be safety issue, so this patient might have been violent at Providence 4 hours earlier. This may be a patient who's got a care plan that was up and important, or this may be that they have visited, you know, five or more emergency departments in the last 6 months, depending on what that hospital sets as their standard for it. And then I can pull up that care plan and see their additional information. Does that answer your question, Representative, through the chair?
Follow up real quickly. Okay, so I understand that. And so the patient would have to sign over, they would have to sign for that, correct? They're saying, I agree that all of these medical facilities will share information on myself as a patient.
So, Representative, through the chair, kind of two things. When you check into the emergency department, you basically agree that if this has to do with your medical emergency at that moment, that we have ability to access. So we do that already for HIPAA. So someone comes into the emergency department and they're unresponsive and they have a wristband on from another hospital, I call that hospital and say, hey, it looks like you were recently seen. Can I get some additional information? So there's a HIPAA agreement when someone immediately comes in. If you then go to your outpatient clinic, they can't automatically access that information. So the information is restricted unless that's your panel of patients. So if you're a primary care provider, you could submit to CMT, this is my panel of patients, and you have medical agreements with them saying, okay, these are the patients I'm caring for, and then have access to that. How we worked with the mental health court is we have all the patients within the mental health court signing a full information release saying that I am willing to share this information. So if someone's in the community, they would sign it, say as part of this mental health court, I'm willing to share this information. Only those people who have signed that information would be able to get access to it. Does that?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Then answers it. Thank you.
Representative Tarr?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was actually going to ask a little bit about HIPAA and how that works. So I think that's largely been resolved from those two answers. But with other EMRs, is the idea that, you know, everybody's got their own EMR system, but then this is a tool that feeds into that. And so, you know, you don't get any information that's unnecessary, but then all of that is overlaid by the requirements of HIPAA?
as Representative Tarr through the chair, yes, and I'm going to just turn over to Ben. He's like the IT expert that can talk about these details of it. From my perspective, it all works and it shows up and I have what I need, so I will let him talk about the IT component.
Howdy to Representative Tarr through the chair. Thank you. How it essentially works is we are fed through every health system a very narrow slice of data. Essentially, when someone shows up in the ER, they send us, you know, we use the parlance of ping, that has a little bit of that patient data, not their full clinical record. It's only what's relevant essentially to that moment. We match that against our larger database because we're now collecting millions of these from every single hospital and EMR in the system and essentially say, has this patient been seen anywhere else, and is there risk associated with them due to their actions, due to the medications they're on, due to just the sheer number of encounters? This is someone that's been going to multiple health systems and is clearly not at the right site of service, and we want to let the ED physician know that. So each EHR keeps their kind of very deep clinical repository on each patient. We just aggregate this one piece of narrow information on all of them. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm. And as a follow-up, I guess, and why I wanted to kind of understand that is that when we've tried to work on our prescription monitoring database, for example, issues of privacy have come up. And so, you know, HIPAA sort of protects you from that, but then each opportunity through, you know, electronic records essentially is a potential opportunity for, you know, some kind of data breach or something like that. And so I just wasn't sure, you know, sort of if those things overlay and if those are any concerns that you've ever, I would imagine those are concerns that have come up, maybe not unique to Alaska.
Yeah. Representative Tarr, Chair, I spend most of my time dealing with data privacy concerns because of this issue. Essentially, again, HIPAA, ironically, of course, was set up, the P in HIPAA is for portability, not privacy, but I think we're all very aware of the risk of a data breach. We've never had one, mm-hmm. We've never had a HIPAA violation, but by staying in front of it, essentially, to make sure that we're within federal statute and then state-specific statute, we ensure that, again, that the risk of this is less likely. But absolutely, it's where we spend most of our time precisely for that issue and concern.
Thank you.
I have a question, primarily around implementation. Your presentation here says that you went live in February 2017 at Providence Hospitals in Alaska. Is that correct?
Yes.
All right. And what's the timeline for the rollout for the rest of the participants?
Implementation, primarily because of the privacy and security mm-hmm. Concerns, the bulk of the implementation is on the legal review, so that usually takes about 3 to 4 months, but the IT implementation is a fairly light lift, mm-hmm. And Providence went live rather quickly. They were our first to go live because they've already done this and in their other hospitals in Washington and Oregon, mm-hmm. and they're very passionate about the rollout and getting it in their facilities, and so they've really been the leader in the implementation. And so we went this month, we've been to every mid and large size hospital with the exception of one that we're about to schedule, and we're talking about we're going through the system demo, contracting, and getting our hospitals off and running. And we were today is Ashna's fly-in, so before we presented here we gave a pitch again to all the hospital CEOs that are very on board with this initiative and supporting what was put into place with SB 74.
Sure, I think you know, from my perspective, it's really important that we have multiple, you know, or as many hospitals as possible involved. Providence in Alaska is distributed geographically, so you know, if somebody goes from Seward and then they go to Anchorage, then that really matters. But I understand that the problem is more a matter of frequent flyers back and forth between sort of, you know,
absolutely,
urban areas. The other question I had with regard to rollout and implementation is there was reference earlier to prescription drug monitoring program, and I believe that we did actually pass a prescription drug monitoring program last year, and I double checked just to make sure because I remember that vote. And what's the timing for integrating that information in? Or will it be integrated?
Chair Sponholz, it's my understanding that part of the language in SB 74 around the prescription drug monitoring program allowed for some regulations that might go into effect in July. And so our project is just starting the implementation of this system, but we hope to have talks with the prescription drug monitoring program soon.
So there's regulations that need to roll up prior to the prescription drug database being integrated?
It's my understanding that's already underway, but
all right.
There's still work to be done on our project.
So in the back to time frame, what's the goal end date for complete rollout of integrated ED coordination? Of EDI. I like it.
Well, the legislation that was passed wanted us to start the project by the end of December, coordinating with the state of Alaska, and that has been, we started in May, so we were well underway with our project timeframes. I think we need to give our hospitals a good 6 months to get this contract signed, legal review, and us off and running. And then we want to roll this out to communities and primary care. They can access it through the portal. So that would be the phase two. We also have not had a lot of discussions with our rural critical access hospitals, and because we started primarily with the rail belt and the larger to mid-sized hospitals to get the momentum going, and then we hope to bring on the rural critical access hospitals. So I hope that answers your question. There's quite a lot of work to be done, so I don't want to commit to all of the timelines in the project, but I can say safely that my hope is that within 6 months we have this in all of our large to mid-size EDs.
Madam Chair, so you know the IT component is one, but then there's all this additional component, and so this is just the beginning. So I think that this IT rollout is really kind of that first 6 months. There is legislation. When we talked about it specifically, it says with the prescription drug database, we're finishing that regulation component. But then this beginning of working with communities and how do we do care coordination? I think it's going to depend on what happens with the state level, what happens with the RFPs and care communication and care coordination. But this is just the beginning, and I think that there's a lot of opportunity to build on this, to look at end of life care, to look at better care coordination, to look at other cost savings issues as well as patient health that can go on forever trying to kind of improve the health in our community. So I never see this project ending.
Sorry, guys.
All right. Is there any other questions from the committee?
I do have one other question.
Representative Tarr.
Thank you. I'm just wondering, because we have significant populations who coverage comes through Indian Health Services and then through TRICARE, and does that have any influence over how these programs work, or do they participate elsewhere?
Yeah, so great question, Representative, through the chair. We have been working with Indian Health Services extensively. They do a fantastic job of doing primary care and care coordination. Being able to have access to that information in all the emergency departments only makes sense, and we're working closely with them. The JBEAR, this is a whole set of a different situation. So as mentioned, in Washington State and Oregon, it's live in every hospital except for those. So we are working with Washington and Oregon leaders as well as leaders within the VA system and looking for any support that we can have to kind of take this to a federal level to say what can we do to make some federal changes in the regulation to get them on board as well. So that will be one limitation here because it's been limited other places, but I don't see that as a permanent barrier. It's a temporary one, and we just have to continue to work on integrating these systems.
Thanks. Good question. All right. All right. Not hearing any additional questions, I want to thank you guys for coming in and presenting on this. It was good to learn about the next step of this process, and it's always nice to see, implementation of an idea come along so quickly. So thanks for your progress there. So the next meeting of Health and Social Services Committee for HESS will be on Thursday, March 2nd, and we will be hearing HB 43 again. We will also be hearing HB 123, which is price transparency, and we'll have a presentation from the Key Coalition. And with that, the meeting is adjourned at 4:47. Thank you.